Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Phil Connell, a writer and director whose first feature, Jump Darling, stars Thomas Duplessis as Russell, a young drag performer at a personal and professional crossroads, abandoning his partner in Toronto to go out and see his grandmother in Prince Edward County and figure out what he wants and where he's going. It opened the Toronto Inside Out Film Festival last fall, and it's available on VOD today, with a bittersweet boost in visibility because it features the final screen performance of Cloris Leachman as Russell's grandmother. Phil picked a bigger splash, Luca Guadagnino's luxurious 2016 remake of Jacques Duret's 1969 drama La Piscine, a story of a very comfortable couple who've retreated from the world, only to have that retreat disrupted by the arrival of her producer and former lover, and his young daughter. Tilda Swinton and Matthias Schoenaerts are the couple, a rock star resting her voice after career-saving surgery and her protective photographer partner. Ralph Fiennes and Dakota Johnson are the ex and the daughter, and all of them are on a collision course with one another. This is Someone Else's Movie.
I chose it because I only just saw it recently, but I've been sort of going through like a bit of a Luca I've seen a lot of Luca recently, so I felt like, you know, I felt like it was just, I had enough to talk about, you know, like there was a wide enough range to dig into, not just the film itself, but kind of like to stretch it into, you know, some of the kind of like thematic elements and everything else that kind of the threads that are transcending, you know, certainly I Am Love, and which I watched many years ago, but watched again recently. You know, I find his work to be kind of quite politically interesting. So I find it, you know, I find it to be entertaining, but I also find there to be, you know, there's some interesting politics in his work, and not necessarily, you know, governmental politics, but just, you know, kind of viewpoints on the world that are kind of coming through his work that are interesting and sometimes in conflict with the worlds that he's painting. And so I found that kind of interesting, in addition to them just being generally entertaining. I also recently watched his series on HBO, We Are Who We Are. I don't know you've seen that. And, you know, Luca is just really interesting because he does tackle a lot of queer themes, and, you know, his work is just dripping with sex. And, I think it's the kind of politics of the films that I find really interesting, and how, like, you know, that you see those threads. And I really like when you can kind of feel like you're getting a sense of this, the, you know, a bit of the psyche of the filmmaker, through the work.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Certainly the two, I mean, they were made almost back to back, A Bigger Splash and Call Me By Your Name. And they're both about snakes in the garden, kind of, you know, these perfect idyllic worlds that are invaded by outsiders who don't necessarily mean to destroy, but can't help but unbalance the comfort of everyone involved. And what struck me about A Bigger Splash, just rewatching it the other night, was that this is the movie. I mean, not only is there a snake in the garden daily, they tell us that they get these snakes all the time, but it just sort of wears its conflict openly in a way that his other films don't. Like, it's so happy to have Ralph Fiennes running around being a chaos agent, and to the point where we're being seduced by him as well. The film is already seduced by him, and Guadagnino just, I'm going to butcher his name every time.
I'm not a native
Italian speaker.
I actually have trouble saying it. I'm never sure I'm saying it correctly.
Yeah. I think it's Guadagnino.
Guadagnino. Yeah, Guadagnino. Exactly. It's like, which consonants am I supposed to leave out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's encouraging, like, he's already besotted with this performance, and I get it, because who wouldn't be? Like, what filmmaker wouldn't want to capture that? But yeah, Fiennes' character performs the same function as Armie Hammer's in Call Me By Your Name, which is to show up and take what he wants. And we later realize, oh, that's not charming. That's actually horrible. I mean, Call Me By Your Name is a very delicate, beautiful depiction of what could be easily construed as child abuse, as grooming, uh-huh, and pedophilia. I mean, it's not presented that way because we're watching this filtered memory of a relationship that's a coming of age story to the character, but objectively it's problematic. And the thing about A Bigger Splash, I think, that makes it more okay, although there is that revelation of a character's actual age, is that it's a hedonistic film from the get-go and everybody's sort of already into it. That's not enough to excuse it, but it is a context that people are operating in within the world of the film that sort of makes it better, I guess.
That's interesting. You know, like Call Me By Your Name, which I saw when it came out, and it's like less in my head. Like I have a less like concrete memories of all the different pieces of it, obviously, but I actually read the book fairly recently, which I've read after. Yeah. But I remember, you know, obviously seeing Call Me By Your Name, that that those feelings of like, oh, this is a bit uncomfortable, you know, was something that I was feeling as well. But yeah, it really wasn't much talked about, like that aspect of it. Like the love story aspect of it was seemingly very widely embraced. And you know, the beauty of it and just the way it was the way it was presented and sketched out, that aspect of it was, you know, the sort of uncomfortable age difference aspect just wasn't really explored. And I think a lot of that, frankly, is a testament to the strength of Chalamet's performance in that film. Like he's just so, he's just got this incredible charisma, this sexual charisma as well, you know, that I think is very, you know, that is just jumps off the screen for, I think, you know, I shouldn't speak for every viewer, but I feel like that was very, you know, obviously launched him into the stratosphere for a reason. And, but now thinking about A Bigger Splash, you know, you're talking about that aspect and the relationship between the two films, you know, the sort of the underage or, you know, the teenage, you know, the teenage female character who gets together in Bigger Splash in an implied way. I guess we never, in fact, I watched it again and I was like, so are we supposed to think that they did or they didn't, or, you know, like they vague, do leave it, it? They do leave it ambiguous. But anyway, that part kind of went over my head, like, you know, in terms of like what you're talking about, like those two threads, I actually hadn't thought about those two threads between those two works in the same way. Like what for me is the interesting kind of like, you know, political / worldview dynamics that kind of go through some of his works is just this idea of like Ralph Fiennes' character in Bigger Splash is kind of like, and you know, this, the metaphor of her having lost her voice, right? This, you know, the star, the, you know, the thing that she monetizes, the thing that created her celebrity, that did all, you know, the sort of the capitalistic element of her participation in the capitalist world, you know, has been taken away from her due to this surgery. And, you know, she's sort of settled into this kind of, let's leave aside for a sec that it's decadent, but settled into kind of like a simpler existence, right? I'm going to live on the land. I'm going to enjoy food. I'm going to enjoy swimming. I'm going to enjoy sex. I'm going to, you know, you can describe that as hedonistic or decadent. And, you know, I think that has to do with the context, but, and then you've got kind of Ralph Fiennes like swooping in with kind of the, like, when are you going to get your voice back? When are we going to get back on the train? And, you know, kind of this, almost the Americanism aspect, you know, ownership, money, you know, forward momentum, all this kind of thing, you know, pace. And, you know, those are themes more so that I see in I Am Love, right? Like the rejection of establishment ways of thinking, the rejection of wealth, the rejection of, you know, the rejection of gender, you know, or traditional views of gender, you know, that kind of happens in I Am Love. And, you know, those ideas are much more sketched out in that film, but I just find it interesting how, you know, Ralph Fiennes' character in Bigger Splash is this like charismatic kind of successful, you know, take what he can, you know, knows he's obscene and is okay with it, you know, and is also highly entertaining and enjoyable as a person, but also is a little bit disgusting, you know? And
yeah.
And like, that's kind of like, you know, I hate to say it, like, that's kind of like, you know, I don't know. I just see this sort of, you know, and all of his films have Americans coming into Italy, you know, or all of his, yeah. you know, and We Are Who We Are is the same thing, except it's an American army base. I don't know if you've seen it, but.
I've not had the time to catch
it. It's really interesting. Cause it's like that piece is like, set in Italy, and it's set on an American army base. And it's about a bunch of army brats who like travel around the world with their parents who are soldiers to these, you know, remote army bases. In that case, it's like, you know, so it's this queer kid and his mom and his mom's the new Chloe Sevigny is the new colonel on the base, like the, you know, the new head of the base or whatever. So that one kind of flips the script a little bit, but like this whole notion, like, I sort of feel like there's this European versus American kind of worldview thing that happens in his work.
Oh, I think so.
But I find you know, I just find that really interesting.
Yeah, it's all over Suspiria too. I mean, I'm not a fan of the film at all.
I watched it this weekend in preparation.
Okay, the Swinton Johnson reunion is kind of interesting. And it is like,
right.
I am amazed that the Tilda Swinton, who is great in everything and has been all along, actually does seem to really relish the work she does with Guadagnino more than anybody else. Like, she really comes to life in his films, even when she's playing, you know, an 83-year-old German man in Suspiria. There's a sense of play that comes out in her. And yeah, that the one thing that the remake does that the original doesn't do is really kind of rip into the idea that it is a story of a foreigner. It is an American in Germany. Like Jessica Harper's version of the character is just so traumatized and frightened from the very beginning that there's no sense of displacement or any of that stuff. And Guadagnino's movie, by adding an hour to the running time, just adds all the other stuff in the Bader-Meinhof things going on, that there's a real sense of an American not knowing how to act and what to do in a foreign land, which, and of course, you know, Fiennes' character has the opposite problem. He doesn't actually care about what he's doing. And I think he's supposed to be American, but with Fiennes, you can never really tell. There's a sense that he came over, you know, from London in the 70s and just never left and is thoroughly Americanized. But he is, for all intents and purposes, he is the ugly American in this world.
Right.
Paul, I think, is from they meet in New York. I think he's supposed to be from New York, but that doesn't really come through either.
I had the same issue with that. I'm like, is he American? Like, it's like, yes, he's American. Like, I guess he's American, you know, they meet in New York. But yeah, I had the same issue. I wasn't really sure where we were supposed to think he was from. But again, I still, like, regardless of that, I still felt like the tension was there. Like, you sort of feel like she just is done. You know, you feel like she is, you know, and her rejection of him is, you know, just as much a rejection of, you know, that life. As it is about, you know, as about the particular character, you know, and that, you know, she wants to retreat to kind of a simpler life. And, you know, you see, and, you know, and just like the obsession over food, like the way he shoots food and, you know, like that's, I don't remember to what extent that was in Call Me By Your Name, but it was certainly in I Am Love, right? Like, you know, she just... these moments of just, you know, and obviously falling for a chef in that film, but like,
well, the ricotta scene in this film obviously is the one, right?
Yeah. Right. And like, and just like the driving off into the hills, right? Like the way he kind of, you know, going up the dusty road, leaving, you know, in, I guess in I Am Love, leaving Milan behind and, you know, driving up into the dusty hills and, you know, where it's like, I'm in a, out of the kind of, you know, prison of that, you know, crazy home that doesn't look more like an embassy than a home, and into just kind of like a simple little cottage where you have, you know, just the bare necessities and kind of, and in I Am Love, what's interesting too, is like, I've never seen Tilda Swinton looks, you know, you know, she just looks like such a porcelain doll, like, you know, just the way they put, you know, and you know, as she sheds that, you know, at the end is just so compelling, you know, when you think of, especially when you put it in the context of today's, like, you know, gender politics and kind of thing, you know, that just carries a lot of weight. You just kind of like, oh, okay. Like, you know, she's zipped up in these like beautiful, but tight, uncomfortable sort of things, you know, like presented as this, yeah, this constructed ideal. And, you know, it's kind of like the breaking down of that. And she's just trying to get out of it. Although it was interesting that the house in I Am Love does resemble the embassy house, does like kind of look not unlike the dance academy in Suspiria. Like, yeah, there's like, you know what I mean? Like,
there's a little bit of a fortress to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the kind of like, they just, you know, those big kind of brownish, you know, framed oversized windows and just kind of, I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's he just has a reflexive dislike of that sort of architecture. I mean, there's what's it supposed to be, a chalet in Call Me By Your Name? That's also just like a country estate. It's everything is appointed and elaborate in his movies in a way that, I guess, the whole idea that his obsession with rejecting materialism is only possible if you've already achieved a state of wealth where you can just detach, which is obviously the political conflict you're talking about.
Yes, exactly.
This, you know, Marianne Lane has created a simpler life where she can just read all day and ignore the world, but it's because she's literally beaten herself half to death in the pursuit of her fame, right? Like, she's destroyed her voice to be that famous, to be that successful.
Yes.
And so this is an escape, but it's also, I think it's very clear in Swinton's performance that this is the only option she has left. Like, if she keeps going, she'll die.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and like and certainly the moment at the end of the film in a bigger splash, like the, you know, the autograph moment is like, you know, just that interesting moment of like, I'm still facing this idea of being owned. You know what I mean? Like this, you know, she's trying to get out from being productized and being kind of owned, you know, and it's just very compelling. But yes, exactly. But that's exactly it, right? It's like,
but it's also the price she pays to get away, right? Literally, to get away with everything. Not that she did anything, but, you know, I suppose we can, because the movie's 6 years old. There's really no reason not to talk about the mechanics of the ending, but. Yeah. Yeah, Marianne's fame is what blinds other people to the possibility of culpability, right? Like, it's, her fame is allowing her to live the life she wants on every level. And
yeah,
I think the final scene of the film is a suggestion that it's also a cage that she's built for herself, but it's a cage in which she gets to literally not go into prison. So it's an interesting contradiction that the film is fascinated by. And I'm kind of curious, because I somehow missed the first time through that this is a remake. I'd never seen La Piscina. I wasn't aware that there was a
Piscina. I didn't know that either. I didn't know that either. I read about that in the lead up to this call. Was it a remake or just
it
like
is,
a
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like, I didn't. The beats are almost identical, which is really interesting. They're the plot points rather than the actual dramatic moments. But
you've seen
No, I still haven't. I've done some reading on it though.
I see.
And I'd love to see it because it sounds like it was completely different and yet exactly structurally the same. And I think I'm fascinated the most by why Guadagnino would want to do this, to remake it. And I think the trick here was the film's obscure enough that you can get away with it, that it doesn't need, like, Fiennes has nothing to compete against. And you know what? I'm actually going to stop and look it up because I'll get it wrong otherwise. but yeah, it's a Jacques Duret film from 1969. It was the first movie he made with Alain Delon, but they'd made like 9 films together. Yeah, Romy Schneider, Maurice René, Jane Birkin plays the daughter.
Wow.
The names are the same. It's Marianne, Harry, Penelope, and Jean-Paul, but Paul is definitely that guy. And yeah, Romy Schneider and Tilda Swinton are galaxies apart. They're not even the same species. But I think that's it. If you're going to remake a film that not too many people remember, you break away, you make it as visually different as possible. And that's his thing anyway, just the sumptuous visuals and the embrace of the wealth and privilege that surrounds everyone. And then you just let the actors figure it out themselves. I mean, Jane Burke and Dakota Johnson are also radically different personalities. But I think also he knows that if he's got Ralph Fiennes doing that, that Harry is completely different from the other one. As far as I can tell, Maurice Rene's version of Harry was just a little more persuasive and direct rather than expansive and explosive the way that Fiennes is.
Right. I don't feel like I've ever seen him in a performance quite like that. Maybe I have, and I just don't remember it because my memory betrays me a lot of the time. I'm like, oh yeah, I have seen that. Oh yeah, I guess that's true. But he was just so entertaining in a way that was, you know, you just couldn't, I mean, he was so funny. You know, that scene where he just does, you know, where he goes off on the music.
Rescue, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, his like, you know, Elaine, like kind of like dancing, on the cliff over there. Like, it's so funny and it's great to watch. And, you know, you're just smiling in anticipation of it because it's just, anyway, and what's great about it too, is that like, you know, as a viewer, his charisma is, and his wackiness is so infectious that you can totally understand, you know, why the characters feel that way. You know, like you really are, you feel like you're living the film in that sense, like in terms of Tilda Swinton's conflict with like, oh God, here he is. Oh my God, I'm not going to be able to look away. Like, oh God, you know, am I going to fall under the spell again?
The trick I think to Harry is that Fiennes knows what he's doing. Like he is somehow, it's that thing that I've been talking about it a lot with Christopher Plummer lately, just because I've been talking about Christopher Plummer since he died. They both have a quality of allowing the audience to know how much fun they're having without breaking character.
Mm.
And like with Fiennes, it comes up in stuff like the Grand Budapest Hotel, where we're allowed to see the performance that he's giving in character. And here, I don't know that Harry is performing. I think Harry is basically just that all the time. Mm-hmm. But Fiennes lets us see how much fun it is to play someone like that without worrying about what it would be like to actually exist in the real world. Because I love watching Harry. I would not want to ever be in a room with him. He is a disaster waiting to happen. He's just this untrammeled narcissist who has never... I mean, it's like you could dismiss this film and a lot of Gwendolyn Union's work as white privilege, the movie. But I think with Harry, we actually see the downside of it. Like he is always about to fall, and he's not going to get what he wants from Marianne. So there's no way this movie ends well for him. And when it ultimately goes where it goes, that's still surprising. And that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because it robs everybody else of the closure of having him just leave. You know, because he won't leave until he gets what he wants, and he's not going to get what he wants. And it's the, you know, the irresistible object and the irresistible force and immovable object issue. Mm-hmm. And I think the film's even aware of that in a really otherly way, an otherworldly way, because by taking Marianne's voice away, Swinton is an object. Like she makes herself an object. And that turned out to be her decision, which is fascinating to me.
I read something about that, but not enough to really fully grasp. Like it was like something like she agreed to do it if she wouldn't have to speak. Is that what I read?
Yeah, the original script and the original film has Marianne with dialogue. She is a speaking character. And Swinton said in an interview about a year later that she had run out of words in her own life. She had reached a point where she just didn't think she had anything to say. And so she didn't want to act on film because she wouldn't believe it herself. And she said, you know, like, I'll do this if I don't have to talk. And Gwendolyn found a way for it to work.
Crazy.
It is.
Well, and it does work really well. Like it is very captivating. Yeah. Like you just think it's like this, you know, for her to carry the whole thing in that manner. And even when she does finally speak, you know, like when she speaks with the, you know, over the, you know, her raspy, whatever, it's just, it's like, it's like painful to watch, but also, you know, because you just assume that it would be painful, but also because I don't know, it's just, it's really good as a device.
Yeah. Well, we're not used to seeing Tilda Swinton be graceless, right? Yeah. Like she is just, I mean, I've interviewed her and she is an unearthly presence, and something about her skin registers differently on camera, or you just, right. It pulls in the light rather than reflects it. So you just constantly,
What was she like?
Oh, she was great. It was a film where she played a scientist who makes her own clones, but they're weird and small. And I don't know how to describe it. It was a director friend of hers. It's someone else she'd made a number of movies with named Lynn Hirschman Leeson. And I got two things out of that experience. One is that it is entirely possible that Tilda Swinton and David Bowie were the same person, and there's no way to prove that they aren't. Technolust was the name of the film. It was 2002. And cool. The other thing is that she will do absolutely anything for her friends, for people she respects or admires, artists that she likes.
Right.
So she made this movie right at a point in time where she was rocketing up in terms of her fame. She was being pushed for an Oscar nomination for The Deep End. And then she just went off and made this tiny little project with a friend of hers and gave her all. And it's a weird little movie, but she did not hold back or phone anything in. And I get that with Guadagnino too, because they've made, is it four films together now? Or three, and one is still in production. But I know sounds she's working about right. with him again. Yeah. So she's willing to do anything. But like the thing about the voice here tells me that she'll do it on her own terms every time, which I find really fascinating. And and she is, she's intelligent and erudite and ethereal and everything you want her to be, or at least she was almost 20 years ago now. I thought it was more recent. But I'm absolutely fascinated by what she chooses to do with her fame and how she does it. She works with Mark Cousins on these traveling cinema projects all the time, or she did before the pandemic shut everything down, just bringing movies to rural communities in the United Kingdom, just because she can, just because it's something he wants to do. And she's like, I can help you. I'm famous and people will pay attention.
Right.
But it's not transactional as far as I can tell. Like, she's just a genuinely good person and a patron of the arts. I guess it comes from working with Derek Jarman in the early years and just, you know, coming up that way and being, it's almost like the stage actor's creed, where you just, you're always in the ensemble no matter what you're doing, and you want to help and bring visibility to things. But also on some level, I think with a bigger splash, like, she knows that even though Ray Fiennes' character, like, even though Harry is the center of attention, Marianne can take up just as much space, especially if she doesn't talk and just uses her presence.
And it, you know, one of the things I was thinking about on my second viewing was just the Dakota Johnson's character, what's her name, Penelope, and just like whether, you know, first of all, like the father daughter thing, and whether we're supposed to buy that she's his daughter or not. I mean, obviously she brings it up with the paternity test thing, but you're not really sure if that's like just a provocation on her part, you know, or a legitimate thought or feeling. And you know, whether she's been brought there by Harry as like, you know, as an intentional act of disruption or just the circumstances that he describes. Like, you know what I mean? Like, her whole character is kind of like, you're really uncertain as to, you really don't know fully whether, you know, why she's there and how she came to be there and what the truth is around her character at all.
Yeah.
And I just find that really interesting, which, you know, obviously at the end we learn that, you know, she's, you know, been lying to them and, you know, and all that kind of stuff that, you know, so there is, you know, some manipulation there, but she's also 17. So it's like, well, you know, and she's just met her father, you know, so you can kind of slice it a variety of ways. Like, you can say, no, like, you just take it as it is straight up. Like, she's 17, she's lying because she's pissed off and she doesn't really know what she wants and what she's doing in life. She's been dragged over to Italy by her father, who she hardly knows, you know? And so, or it's like, no, she's in on this whole thing. And she's got her own agenda and she's pursuing that agenda. She doesn't seem particularly broken up when her father dies, but, you know, so it's just, I found like, you know, kind of, the way she's sketched out as a character to be very, very interesting, because you're sort of left with a lot of questions, but not necessarily really any closure narratively, you know, in terms of what she means.
Yeah, I think this time through, I came away pretty confident that the fact that she is playing her own agenda and withholding things from people means she is Harry's daughter, because that's what he does. Like, they're either she learned it from him in this really short time, or it's innate and he's just passed that along. It makes perfect sense that she would do what she does and hide what she hides. Maybe the age thing. I mean, she keeps insisting she's 22, so people will take her seriously. And that is something a teenager would do. And the other thing, like, Johnson was 26, I think, when she made the film. So she's playing 10 years younger, which is harder to swallow.
Yeah.
But I guess if you came from Harry Hawks, you probably would age at a terrifying rate as well. Like, there's just the sense that, like, he's wearing on her and leeching from her in a vampiric sort of way. It kind of plays into the way Johnson presents herself and the way that the camera presents her. I mean, the movie is in love with everyone. The sensualism that Gordon, you know, brings to every project, where, you know, the surfaces are the most interesting thing, and the granite and the marble and the textures of the food. But then also he sees his actors as objects in the same way, to be, you know, pushed in on and examined and reveled in. Yeah, I mean, I think Johnson's a really interesting actor. I know she gets a rough ride because of the 50 Shades movies, but the more I learn about her and, oh, they're terrible. They really are. But the more I learn about Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan, it's very clear that they just did them because it looked like it would be easy. And, you know, they're, again, they're, those are very stylish, sensualized, you know, you do one of those movies and keep your wardrobe, it's probably worth it.
Yeah. Right. Right, right.
But she's like, she's responding to something here. Like, she's up to, like, she's just the fact that she's not being blown off the screen by three of the greatest actors of their respective generations is kind of impressive.
Yeah, no, I mean, she's very captivating in the role. And, but she also, I also just find how she's got like this, you know, there's like a simmering anger. You know, there's a simmering anger in that character. And again, like, you can chalk that up to being a teenager. Although 17, you know, I don't know, 17 often, you know, that the angry stage is, that's to me, the angry stage is a little earlier than that, but maybe that's just my own experience. You know, so her character stays with me a lot because of how they kind of unleash it right at the end, you know, how they by unleashing those facts, you're kind of like left with like, what was her participation in this, you know, and what are we to take from that? You know, it's kind of, it's just like, it punctuates the whole thing in such a way as to think, you know, that like, it sort of feels like there's being weight lent to it, but you're not really sure how to process the weight. At least that was for me, you know, or if it's just like, where it was just like, oh, this is interesting. You know, we're closing the loop on her narrative, you know, and there isn't a lot of meaning to it. I'm not sure.
Well, with the transactional nature of Harry too, there's the possibility that, I mean, it seems pretty obvious that he's not just there to get Marianne back to work. He wants her. He wants to resume his position as her lover too, and take over from Paul, because he very, you know, grandly let Paul meet her and made it possible for that relationship to happen after he and Marianne broke up. And so in that case, you can interpret that Penn is there for Paul, right? Like, as a distraction or as a consolation prize, which
he's brought her there as he's brought her to be like the sort of the forbidden fruit or whatever, you know, to be, or the unforbidden fruit.
Is he giving her to Paul, or is he putting her in Paul's way as a temptation to discredit him? It's ambiguous, because with Harry, it could be all of it. Like, he offers, like, again, it's Fine's performance, but the mania that this man has gives me the sense that he is considering all of these things in the moment, and it's not even clear what his original plan was, or if he just thought, oh, I'll bring her, and that was where it stopped for him.
Right. And I'm not fucking my daughters.
That I believe.
Yeah, no, me too. But it's just so funny. You're obscene. Of course, everybody's obscene, which, you know, for me, that was like the, you know, big line in the movie. Yeah, like, yeah. For the, you know, in terms of the, like, the grander picture we were talking about earlier in terms of like the politics, right? Like this idea of obscenity and taking and what we can get and amassing and, you know, whether that's, you know, celebrity or decadence or lovers or whatever. But like, to me, that was very telling in terms of, you know, some of the ideas he was exploring or the tensions he personally has about, you know, like, you know, capitalism as a means to an end so that you can, like, you know, it just sort of like, you know, living in Italy, you know, it's just a very interesting kind of notion, like, of obscenity and what obscenity is, you know?
Yeah. And how people determine what obscenity is on their own personal scales.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned that there was one thing I wanted to ask you about, because it struck me the first time I watched it, and struck me again when I watched it again. And I don't remember seeing this in his other work, but the way he did a lot of these, and it seemed to be linked to Harry's character, I think, like, at least in my head, that's what was happening. But he had these like really abrupt, he would have these really abrupt push-ins, like, you know, sort of Steadicam push-ins on objects, mm-hmm. you know, and you see the first one in the film is like, on the arrival screen in the airport.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like, we're racing to look at it, but the characters haven't physically moved.
Yeah, exactly. And it shows up a few other times in the film, like once on like the wallet and the belt and stuff as he's taking it off before he goes into the pool, once on Tilda Swinton's back. And then there's another one anyway. And it just, they struck me as kind of odd, but at the same time, because it repeated in a variety of places throughout the film, there was obviously an intention to it. It wasn't just like, oh, we rushed that shot. But I don't remember seeing that in any of his other work. And so I wasn't sure if that was meant to convey, like, it did seem like it was always when something to do with Harry, like Harry was in the scene, or we were anticipating Harry coming into the scene, or it was Harry's things or whatever. And so I wasn't, the way I interpreted it was, you know, sort of this, the frenetic energy that he represents, and kind of like, oh, we're trying to get away from the chaos machine.
Yeah.
You know, and here comes the chaos. But again, I wasn't, you know, and I know you're a bit of a scholar on these things. If you had noticed, like, that had been a thing that he does in other films.
I think you're right. I don't think he does. Right. And I was wondering in this case, whether it was supposed to be things that would later become important to the investigation, but I don't think that's it either. I think,
right.
Just because I was trying to think of, is it like we're watching a flash of memory as it happens of like, oh, that's when, this is proof of something. But I don't know, watching it a second time, I don't know that that's true.
Yeah, they feel a bit random, like random in terms of the things that they're doing it on and the times mm-hmm. that they're doing it, but not random as a device. But yeah, so I was just a bit confused by it, but I thought maybe it was a stylistic thing. Yeah. But I remember I Am Love being much more plodding generally as a film.
Well, his pacing is usually much, much more sedate.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that was my memory, but I wasn't, you know, and same with Suspiria even.
Yeah. I mean, Suspiria is a film that would benefit from that kind of like a shock cut or a zoom. Those would be accommodated within the genre, but
right.
Yeah, no, I don't think he does.
Yeah.
Actually. A lot of slow zooms, slow, deliberate tracking.
Yeah. I think there was some frenetic stuff in the towards the end of Suspiria when all the crazy stuff is happening.
Oh, when people are exploding. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I think there was some there, but that probably kind of stands apart.
Yeah.
In terms of its own thing. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, maybe it is, maybe there's just one that was cut that would have made it all make sense and
right.
just rolled past it somehow.
Right. Right. But there's also, you know, like back to the kind of like the political thing, I also thought like what's interesting is like the two different Harry and Paul's characters and just kind of like the kind of like different versions of masculinity that they represent as mm-hmm. well is something that he kind of that kind of is interesting. You know, I guess more in terms of how they live their life. I mean, they're both, we don't really totally get the sense that, like, there's, you know, a caregiving aspect to Paul. Like, there's a real, like, there's this, you know, this sort of, they look after each other, you know, in like in a more human way, as opposed to in a like bolster each other's role in the world sort of way, which seems like more of the role that, you know, the kind of relationship that she and Harry had, right? And drugs and, you know, amplifying and like, you know, sort of amplifying each other, you know. And so I think that's interesting too, you know, like the fact that he's had, you know, mental health crisis and, you know, and that, you know, that's from the filmmaker's point of view, that is not necessarily, that makes him attractive to Tilda Swinton. Like, you know, that this vulnerability, that they both have by virtue of ailments, you know, over time is actually like something that's drawing the two of them together. So I think that is, again, kind of plays into, you know, some of the ideas that maybe he struggles with as a filmmaker that you see in some of the other movies.
The romance of someone who's rebuilt themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And just also like the nature of how the relationship itself is built. Like, you know, it's like, oh, we're looking after each other as opposed to, benefiting from each other.
Yeah. Well, Paul is absolutely a nurturer and Harry's a parasite.
Yeah.
It's not even a symbiotic relationship. It's
right.
He takes, and maybe he helps in production to make Marianne better, but she's already pretty great.
Right.
So yeah, he's just there to resume that role, and Paul can see right through him.
Right. Although I had a friend of mine who's kind of a bit of a cinephile, and she, one of her struggles with The Bigger Splash was that she had trouble buying Tilda Swinton as the pop star. You know, she had trouble, which kind of escaped me. Like, you know, I was just so captivated by the tale and, you know, and all the things about the movie. But upon I'd heard that after I watched it the first time. And then upon second watch, I was, you know, more scrutinizing that like, you know, that does kind of fade into the background, or that he doesn't invest too much in convincing you that she's one of the greatest pop stars of our time. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't, you know, other than obviously the opening scene on stage and then a little bit in the studio, and the studio stuff doesn't totally convince you of that.
Yeah. It doesn't line up with what the crowd is expecting somehow, right?
No, like, you know, like, it's like, you're not like seeing this grand production of what you can imagine as a pop song that's going to take the world by storm in that session at all. You know what I mean? Like, at best you're seeing like, you know, sort of like a Joni Mitchell kind of like session of, you know, a respected artist doing her thing, you know? Yeah. So
it's like mid-period Patti Smith or something.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's kind of interesting that, I mean, a testament to him as a filmmaker that you can, you know, in terms of the way he does it, that at least for me anyway, I kind of totally overlooked that, you know, I totally bought into that, like without questioning it. But I found it interesting that, you know, this particular friend, that was something that dogged her throughout, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. I wonder if it's supposed to be that she's just reinventing herself on a Bowie scale, because we see her as a glam rocker kind of, even though she doesn't actually sing a note when she's doing it, and then scale down to whatever else she's supposed to be doing in the studio. But I think ultimately it's the way other people regard her that sells it. Like, there's that early scene at the restaurant where the four diners just immediately surrender their table to her and hope that she knows hope that she looks at them for a second, because she is that famous. Mm-hmm. And I guess too, there's the sense that like her,
who also happens to be the police guy.
Yeah. I was trying to think about the villa and if there are any signs of her career, but there really aren't. There are no posters. There are no records. There's just a sense of money, which comes from success.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course she's contrasted too, like just by virtue of the way the movie works, the refugees elsewhere on the island, right, provide an immediate break that they're not registering this humanitarian crisis that's happening, because they're literally on a hill above it, but they're also completely detached from it. The more time you know, the more time they have to do nothing in, the more you're aware of that disparity in the mm-hmm. course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I read something that was, you know, I read some criticism of the film. Some criticism was like bringing that in, but like bringing it in as such a kind of like, it was brought in, but it was really, you know, really kind of a backdrop. Although they bring it more significance at the end when they, you know, when they essentially blame the migrants for, you know, is this an escape route to guilt or discovery or whatever.
We're dealing with 7 other bodies today, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And the notion that anybody could have come up the,
oh, you know, the right, back of course, path. Yeah.
Yeah, anybody could have done this, you know, kind of, or could have had a role. If there was a struggle in the pool, it was probably, you know, someone who was coming to rob us or whatever, you know?
Right.
So it was interesting, you know, again, kind of paying lip service to the, you know, the notion of blaming migrants, you know, so there was there's an awareness of the, like, you know, the decadence mm-hmm. there, but it only goes so far.
Right. Well, I can see that.
Which was some criticism I read, but again, wasn't obvious to me necessarily as I watched it that was, probably because I'm watching it from a place of white privilege.
So much of Gordon Nuño's aesthetic is about ignoring reality, right? Like mm-hmm. just bask in the thing that you're seeing and feel the love and feel the romance and feel the opulence. His characters get to question it, but the movies almost never do, which mm-hmm. is interesting, I think. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's very clearly a comment on Marianne's privilege and stardom at the end, that's what lets her off the hook.
Yeah.
But the film still admires it in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which mm-hmm. is uncomfortable. And I don't
it
know
is
if
uncomfortable.
That's, yeah, I don't know if that's intentional actually either.
Yeah. I mean, I find that there's a lot of movies that do that. Like when there's, you know, when there's like a significant comment on, yeah, significant political comment on the way of the world, but at the same time, the piece of work that's commenting on it is also perpetuating it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I like that, you know, an example for me that's not this that comes to mind is like The Big Short.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like comes to mind is like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, we're doing this like satirical takedown of, you know, of kind of like the world of big finance and, but at the same time, the device of, I forget the character, or the actor, is it?
Oh, Margot Robbie in the title.
Yeah, it's Margot Robbie. I thought it was Margot Robbie, but yeah, exactly. And then we're using this device, which is like satirical, but at the same time, still to me is perpetuating the whole thing. You know what I mean? The whole style of it, the whole style of the film still has that like Wall Street male vibe to it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so
no,
I do.
Yeah.
So I find that interesting. So, you know, thinking about this work wasn't as obvious to me in this work because I guess I'm more into this than I am into the big Wall Street finance vibe, which I really don't identify with. But, you know, the idea of, you know, sitting by a pool in a villa in Italy and, you know, eating, you know, cheese curds, like, yeah, that's pretty attractive. So I was less aware of the sort of like the takedown, like the kind of the negative energy of that. But then what's also interesting about Bigger Splash is there isn't nearly as much, you know, it's just the story, I guess, but you know, there's kind of queer elements in most of his other work that don't exist really here at all.
Yeah. This is a pretty straight story. And I wonder if that's because it originated somewhere else.
Like yeah.
He just there and there, and the concept is so hermetic that there's no way to introduce that aspect of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. And I wonder if, like, you know, I know this is part of a series, you know, Desire series or whatever.
Right.
So if, you know, the sort of like the very obvious connective tissue between the three in terms of like the pools and the dancing in the squares, the American coming into Italy, you know, like, I guess that doesn't happen in I Am Love, but like, I'm wondering if like that will continue, you know, Suspiria is obviously a bit different than all of those things, but I wonder if that will continue in some of his work.
Oh, I'm
or
sure.
If that, or if he, or if he, or if that's captured very much by this Desire series. You know
I mean, nothing about his work suggests that the next one won't be the same. Like he's, I don't even mean that as a negative. It's just like, I suppose I could, if I was being snarky, but yeah, I think he is someone who is an aesthetic filmmaker who like all of his films are about desire. Even Suspiria on some level is about the desire of the witches for this young woman.
Right. And,
you know, I mean, you can reduce it to want, but his whole style is to, you know, super aestheticize whatever it is he's presenting.
Yeah.
So I don't think that just stops because his films aren't overtly about desire. And also calling something a desire trilogy is, it's pretty simplistic in terms of boiling down what these three films are. But just the fact that he, you know, that's how he's been referring to them is kind of, you know, it's like Carpenter's Apocalypse trilogy, that which are three films where the world ends, from a horror filmmaker who always makes movies where the world ends. It's a simultaneously a leap and no leap at all.
It's true, I guess, but because there is a lot of repetition, not just like stylistically, but repetition, like narratively.
Thematically too. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that in that sense, I wonder if that's, you know, in his mind, what's being captured by, you know, this kind of categorization of the three, you know, like the death in the pool, but like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you don't, and that's not in Call Me By Your Name, but there's certainly a lot of pools and a lot of water and a lot of sex in pools and all this kind of stuff that, you know, in the town square and the da 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 da, you know, we are who we are, which is, you know, is coming of age, you know, is a coming of age tale. So it's kids. I mean, they're adults, and it's, much more coming of age queer story, much more sort of and it's set in an army base in Italy, so it does escape, actually it does escape some of these things. Like, it's not, you know, as I recall anyway, romancing food in the same way, like they're, you know, it's about America and Italy, right? So it's like the subculture of the mini army base or the mini grocery store on an army base and the little cafeteria and like this kind of little weird world of kind of eye-opening to me anyway, like the idea of what an actual remote American army base looks like in another country, but they basically create like a little version of America. Right. Mm-hmm. At least according to this series. Right. And so in that sense, like it does abandon some of these things. Now it's a series, you know, so that kind of made me wonder if like this Desire series was, you know, him trying to wrap a bow around a bunch of things that were going to feel similar. And that, you know, that he was going to maybe move on from that in some way. But I actually, We Are Who We Are, I really enjoyed. It's really, and Chloe Sevigny's in it, and she's so interesting. And so she's such a, she's kind of, I mean, interesting, like, you know, she's interesting to someone to kind of think about next to Tilda Swinton, because she kind of has, like, there's some similarities there and kind of like her sort of, how she kind of is like naturally just kind of a queer person, you know, and kind of falls outside of kind of like binary definitions of things. So it's interesting that he cast her in the role that he cast her in, and We Are We Are. She's a big force, but she's, you know, it's much more of a kind of ensemble kind of cast. So, interesting how he keeps the American Italian thing going, but in a very, like, kind of flips the script a bit.
Okay. I'll have to take a look at
it.
And I've been trying to figure out throughout how to line this up with either A Bigger Splash or Guadagnino's own work, his whole body of work, with what you do in Jump Darling. And I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that there isn't a lot of connective tissue. I mean, in a way, Jump Darling is a coming of age story or a coming of self story.
Yeah.
But of somebody who's in his, what, late 20s?
Yeah. He's 31. Yeah.
Right.
I think for me, you know, like I wouldn't say that there's a lot of connective tissue, but if you're like kind of asking me why, you know, why I would have chosen to speak about it on the backs of, you know, going through a release of this film, I guess, you know, I did think about, like I said, choosing You Can Count on Me, which was very influential, and we could easily talk about you know, probably easily talk about much more connective tissue between a film like that and Jump Darling, you know, the small town, two characters coming together, you know, in a crisis, the backstory, you know, blah, 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 kind of how they come together and leave each other. But I guess the reason, you know, why I was taken by this film, and, you know, why some of his work does inspire me is, like I said, some of the exploration of the tension of different lives. So like, you know, like Russell's story in Jump Darling is very much for me anyway, the intention for me is like, it's kind of like choosing life as an artist kind of story. And the tensions that exist in that, you know, the sort of like what you have to give up, you know, traditional lifestyles versus not, and kind of like, you know, what the ex-boyfriend represents, you know, he's like the downtown lawyer gay versus the drag queen gay. And, you know, kind of this, what kind of life do you want?
Mm-hmm. What kind of life? Assimilation versus.
Yeah. And yeah, the assimilation idea, but also just like, what kind of life do I want to lead? And what's that going to mean? You know, and like, what are my values? And are those in conflict with, you know, what I'm doing or not, you know, and how do I align what I'm doing with my values? And the struggle with that. And so to me, if I were to draw any kind of connective tissue between this conversation and The Bigger Splash and, you know, the things that interest me and some of the things that are in Jump Darling, it would be those things. You know, it would be the sort of inside baseball aspects of the kind of queer story going on in Jump Darling, the end of life story, the family drama thing. No, not really. That doesn't really connect. You know, and I was just family, but I am sort of interested in the sort of the sort of politics of films and kind of what they say about how we choose to live our lives and what that says about the people making them and the ideas that are explored around there. And so, you know, I don't pay a ton of attention to that in my movie. There's not a ton of room for that. Like the beating heart of the film is really the relationship between Margaret and Russell. And, you know, I think for most people, that's kind of the thing that they're really going to feel and take away, which is great. I hope. For me, a lot of Russell's narrative is tied to these choices around, you know, can I deal with people's judgment? Does that matter to me? You know, am I going to be poor? Could I have a simpler life? Do I want a simpler life? Those kind of things.
Yeah. And I think, too, that there's something about Jump Darling that rejects the idea of the generational conflict that usually shows up in films like this, I guess is one way to put it, in that everyone understands everyone else and the objections aren't about personality. It's just about viability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his grandmother is unfailingly supportive. His mom is not unsupportive, but just concerned, right? Like she wants to make sure he'll be okay. And that's something that does not often get the kind of texture that you gave it. It's usually just like one line of dialogue about how someone never got along with their dad or that's it. And it's the character doesn't even appear, right? Like it's all right. Backstory. And here making that an active part of it where every character in the movie wants the best for every other character. That's really interesting. And that's not something you see very often. So I was really gratified to see that. And I was trying to figure out if I could hammer it together into Michael Stuhlbarg and Call Me By Your Name, who spends the entire film just watching and holding back on what it is that he can tell his son that will help, but right. He has to wait until his son is destroyed before he can rebuild him with that story.
Right, right.
And that's tragic in its own way. And then we have what Linda Cash does in Jump Darling, which is just watch from the sidelines, knowing like deep in her heart that it's not going to go the way he wants it to and still hoping he'll be happy doing it. That's a really lovely grace note that I was not expecting.
That's so interesting that, I haven't heard a lot of people kind of hit on those aspects. So it's nice. It's nice to hear that. And, you know, in many ways, I have never even really framed them quite that way. It was important for me to not like, I wasn't interested in sort of like, I wanted to make sure I steered clear of any kind of coming out sort of story kind of situation. And so I wasn't really interested in having characters who were non-accepting in the traditional way, but what mm-hmm. But you do have, there is a coming out story aspect in terms of the passion and interest in drag, right? It's like, you know, he hides that from his family. So it's like, oh, it's okay that I'm, you know, I'm gay and I'm in this, you know, relationship with this, you know, successful, you know, lawyer. And, but I'm not sure it's okay if I'm going to be that gay, you know, it's this kind of exploration, a little bit of like the politics of how gay is too gay. And, you know, like, do you, like you said, the assimilation versus, you know, kind of like the
more performative,
you know, the more for, yeah, like, you know, do I, you know, do I be a, am I a heteronormative gay, or am I a queer kind of crusader, you know, am I fighting on the edge, you know, on the fringe for, you know, to kind of move things forward, you know, which is, I think, something that I didn't necessarily set out to do, but it's just, you know, one of the own tension, my own tensions, my own life that I think came through, you know, in the work, you know? And again, maybe that's why I was interested in Bigger Splash, because you see like that idea of like, he's commenting on and sort of questioning, you know, a lot of kind of capitalistic kind of pursuits and values, while at the same time, like taking comfort in the benefits of them, you know? And so, you know, so I, again, like, I think that's what, but it's interesting what you said about like, Linda Cash's character, Ian, sort of, knowing that he feeling in her heart that he won't be successful. I haven't heard that before.
It comes through in the performance, the concern that she expresses, like it's coming from a real place of pain.
Right.
It felt like she's genuinely worried. She's not pressuring him.
Yeah.
Right. Like it doesn't feel artificial. It feels like a genuine worry.
Yeah. Like her instinct is to, and her desire is to be supportive and to be loving. But yes, she has deep concerns about what that will mean for his future. You know, and again, that probably comes very much from, you know, my life, and, you know, my mother in many ways is like that, you know, kind of like, you know, the and again, with respect to, you know, creative life and choosing a creative life, you know, kind of like absolutely supportive, but like, boy, wouldn't it just be easier if you did this other thing, you know, which then that is obviously not a new idea. Like there's nothing new and particularly special about that notion. You see that kind of idea creep up in any story, or I shouldn't say any story, but lots of stories that sure, about yeah. artists, you know, becoming artists, you know, families or people in their lives that, you know, either don't think they'll be successful or wonder, you know, what that will mean for their life and, you know, and make their life more difficult, and all that kind of stuff. But you kind of wrap that into a queer lens, and you've kind of got like a double whammy, right? Because it's like, you know, it's like that's going to be a difficult life, and that's going to be a difficult life. And you put two difficult lives together, and you know, you've made it extra hard for yourself, you know, kind of thing. And so I think that's where. So I guess that's why I wanted to take any kind of. I wasn't interested in having a family that wasn't supportive of his, you know, sexuality, because to me, it muddied the waters.
My thanks to Phil Connell, whose first feature, Jump Darling, is now available on VOD platforms across North America. Thanks also to Angie Power. She knows what she did. You can find Phil on Twitter at LogLady78, all one word, LOGLADY, and the numerals 7 and 8. And you can find A Bigger Splash on DVD from Elevation Pictures in Canada and from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment in the United States. It's also available on Apple TV and Google Play. And in Canada, it's streaming for free on Tubi. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where I'm hosting a bunch of podcasts these days and writing the weekly Now Streaming newsletter, to which you can subscribe at NowToronto.substack.com. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Simcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com, Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're there. Stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out. I'll see you next time.